students anymore, but that I'm just taking up a new job at the Institute of High Energy Physics in Vienna. And so if you want to stop by, you're most welcome to visit. Let me say, if you really want to stop by, you're most welcome to visit. This is unfortunately not the High Energy Physics Institute, but we are actually promised a new building in the next couple of years. Okay, so I will talk about astrophysical and cosmological aspects of light species, which are very weakly interacting. And so during the course of the last 3 days, we have seen many plots of this sort, where one plots a coupling strength versus a mass here, and all sorts of tests come in, precision tests. Here many experimentalists in the room working on these things. And typically what also appears are astrophysical constraints. Here, for example, for Miller charged particles, here you see white dwarf constraints and red giant constraints. Also, we have seen variants of this plot where you have axion light particles, here the axion photon coupling, and here the axion mass. And again, there are constraints appearing here from astrophysical sources. And especially for the QCD axion, FA values, so Betjeque-Quinn values below 10 to the 9 or so, are completely excluded here by these astrophysical constraints. And so I was asked to give a little review over these more traditional constraints. And so very often the name of the game for experimentalists is actually to devise very clever strategies to beat those astrophysical limits and come up with direct laboratory tests which are superior. Okay, so the plan of my talk is first to give you a short qualitative review of how these stellar cooling mechanisms work, so this traditional subject. Then I would like to show you that there can still be surprises in this business. And so last year we had a paper with Haipeng An, who is here in the room, and with Maxime, looking at the emission of dark photons from stars. And I will also briefly comment on work which is just in progress with Adam, who is also here in the room now, and with Anthony, who is a grad student in Victoria. Okay, so very generally, if we have new light degrees of freedom in astrophysics or in cosmology, they can interfere in various ways. So what I call object-based astronomy, there, for example, if you have, they can affect the very messengers we use to do astronomy, so photons and neutrinos. For example, you can have a conversion of a photon into an axion, or you can have, say, you have stereoneutrinos, and then you affect the flavor composition of neutrinos and so on. Another possibility is that you produce light particles in the stars, and they subsequently decay, and they give you observables like X-rays and so on. But what I would like to focus on in this talk here is directly look at the emission of light weakly interacting particles inside the stars. So that will be the main focus here of the talk. And also for cosmology, there's a whole slew of various probes we can have. And here, starting with the CMB, of course, you can have a hot dark matter component. BBN might be affected. Yesterday, we heard a lot about modifications of gravity. And so here, I would like to comment a little bit on the nucleosynthesis part of the story. Okay, so when we look at stars, the single most important tool to understand stars is probably the Wirral theorem. So if you just imagine a self-gravitating, diffuse, dispersed cloud of material which eventually collapses and forms a star, then for such a self-gravitating field in equilibrium, we have the relation that the average kinetic energy equals minus one half of the gravitational energy. And so for a monoatomic gas, the average kinetic energy is just 3/2 kT, and the gravitational potential energy is just the mass of the star, and now I assume it's all the constituents are just protons over the radius of the star. And if you plug in here, for example, the typical values of the sun, you get temperatures of the order of kV, and that's just spot on what's the what's the core temperature of the sun. And so particles with masses below, say, order kV or say 100 kV or so, they are kinetically accessible inside stars. And that's where those constraints come in. Okay, and so now we can look at two limiting cases. If such a light particle is produced inside a star and its interaction is strong, then it will be trapped, just like photons are trapped inside a star, and it can diffuse out, of course. And so often the statement is made that such particles are harmless because they don't lead to an energy loss, but that one has to be a little bit careful because they can actually lead to a radiative heat transfer. And so if the mean free path is longer than the mean free path of a photon, then you can start transferring energy this way, and then you also get constraints. And so, generally speaking, once the mean free path is smaller, then you will not affect the star. But then you have a stronger coupling than the photon, and you're probably hit by some other laboratory constraints. And this is why this is not very often discussed. What is often is discussed is if the interaction is weak, then they can just these particles can just escape like neutrinos do. And so if the interaction is too weak, much weaker, or the interaction rate is much weaker than neutrinos, then again you will not have any constraint because if your cooling process is weaker than neutrino cooling process, then you're again harmless. And so typically, you can make the statement that you should be somewhere in between those two limits to have the strongest constraint. So the impact on stars will be maximized when the particle's mean free path is just on the order of the geometric size of the object. Okay, so now there are two principal ways to react to energy loss. So if you lose energy, the total energy of the system goes down, so the sum of the kinetic plus gravitational energy goes down. And so again, we can look at the Virial theorem, and it informs us that, say, we lose energy, the gravitational potential becomes more negative, so it means we end up with a more tightly bound object, and that means that the kinetic energy has to go up. And so that means you lose energy, but your system heats up, and so an active star, which is supported by radiation pressure, actually has a negative heat capacity. In contrast to that, dead stars, like white dwarfs or neutron stars, they are supported by degeneracy pressure, and there, if you emit energy, you indeed cool down the star, and this is so a stellar energy loss becomes a cooling mechanism. And so there you have a positive heat capacity. Okay, so here this is a plot to walk a little bit through the stellar evolution. This is a color magnitude diagram. So here on the x-axis is a color from blue to red, and on the y-axis magnitude. So this is here, you go upwards, you get more and more luminous stars. And that's a color magnitude diagram of a globular cluster. So globular clusters are very good astrophysical sites to look for stellar evolution, because these are ensembles of stars which contain between thousands or a million stars, which are all formed at the same time. And it's a relatively small object, so if you have, say, one supernova going off, then it sweeps the entire system free of the gas, and so you don't have any subsequent stellar formation anymore. So all those stars in this plot here are pretty much at the same evolutionary age. And so these are isochrones, really. This is what makes globular clusters such clean probes for this energy loss. And so what you see here, this here is the main sequence, where stars are supported by hydrogen burning. Usually the main sequence would extend here to higher luminosity, so the more massive the star, the more luminous it is. But however, this is globular clusters are very old, and so those stars already have consumed their energy, and they moved away from the from the main sequence here into the subgiant branch and afterwards into the giant branch, into the red giant branch here. And so red giants are those objects where you start accumulating the helium ashes from the hydrogen fusion, but the helium has not yet ignited, so it's an inert core, and it eventually actually becomes degenerate only until you collected enough material to ignite it, and then the helium burning goes off and those stars move into the horizontal branch, and now you have a star which is a completely active star again. Eventually, the same process happens again. You start accumulating inert material in the core, and depending on what is the mass, the overall mass of the object, it either becomes a white dwarf or it can explode as a supernova if it's very massive. Okay, and so what are the observables now with which we can constrain light particles? So for red giants, I told you the core is degenerate. So it's a very funny object. So it has a dead star in the middle and an active star on the outside because it has a hydrogen burning shell here. And the important thing to recognize about those stars is that their luminosity is completely determined what is the core mass. So unlike on the main sequence where the luminosity is determined by the overall mass of the star, here it's really the core mass which sets the gravitational potential, and by the virial theorem, again, it sets the temperature, and this tells you how bright is the star. And so if you have an energy loss due to a production of a new particle, you delay the timing of this ignition when helium can start to burn. And so you collect more helium ashes inside the core of the star, the gravitational potential becomes larger, you heat up the star, and the luminosity goes up. And so given that there's an agreement between what you expect from theory and what you observe, you can put a bound on the energy loss, which is on the order of 10 ergs per gram and per second. Once the stars move into the horizontal branch, there's a very similar constraint. However, in contrast to red giants, where we have a temperature of, say, order 10 kV and a density of 10 to the 6 grams, so it's a very dense object. Once helium ignites, the density goes down to 10 to the 4 gram, still at the same temperature. And now we are bounded by, the energy loss is bounded by the overall nuclear energy generation rate. So if you lose energy, you heat up the system. The triple alpha process, which fuses carbon, has a very strong temperature dependence, and you decrease the lifetime of the star. And so the observable here is really, if you look at the global cluster picture here, the stars which live in the main sequence here, this is a very long process. But once they move out of the main sequence, this process happens here rather rapidly. And so there is a prediction of what is the ratio of stars and the red giant branch versus the ratio versus the stars here in the horizontal branch. And those stars essentially have same masses because they are just on the same evolutionary moment. And this happens pretty fast, and so there's a prediction of what is this ratio between the number of those two branches. And again, from there you get a constraint which is very similar. It's just you should lose less than 10 ergs per grams and second. If you go to dead stars, like white dwarfs, they are not supported by any nuclear reactions in the interior. Sometimes they have a hydrogen burning shell, but they just cool by photon emission and neutrino emission. And so the observable here is what is called the white dwarf luminosity function. And so you start out here with, this here is just the number of white dwarfs as a function of their magnitude. You start off with hot white dwarfs, and eventually they cool down. And now, depending if you have a new cooling mechanism, for example, if it looks like a photon luminosity, then you would just decrease the overall amplitude here of the luminosity function, and that's constrained. Or say if you have a temperature-dependent emission mechanism, then you may produce a dip here and cool the hot white dwarfs faster than they're allowed to. cool. All right. Supernova. In supernova, we heard already, I think Sujita alluded quickly to this. When a supernova collapses, we get also a principal bound on the energy loss, because either particles that escape, they essentially shorten the Kelvin-Helmholtz cooling phase. So neutrinos are emitted after the star explodes as the star cools. And since we have observed one supernova, we know what is the number of neutrinos over this few second interval. And if you cool too fast, you just get fewer neutrinos. On the other hand, if the interaction is too strong and you trap the particles, then you get this radiative heat transfer and you produce actually too much neutrinos. And so just as a figure of merit here, you can look at the ratio of the total neutrino luminosity over what is the mass of the protostar in this supernova explosion, and you get about 10 to the 19 ergs per gram in second. And so this is the figure of merit here if you want to look at an energy loss mechanism. Okay, so and here the typical emission processes which happen then inside a star. You can have Compton type processes, you can emit axions this way, or new neutrinos, or neutrinos with non-standard electromagnetic properties. You can have a Primakov type emission, or Bremsstrahlung, or you can have free bound transitions, bound transitions, spare annihilations, everything's possible, what you can think of. And so here just one example for a pseudo-scalar interaction like an axion. So here this is a nice plot which I took from Ruffert's book, which compares now the emission of two objects which have the same core temperature, horizontal branch stars and red giants. But they are different because red giants are degenerate, horizontal branch are non-degenerate. And here you can see that in different systems you have just other processes which contribute to the energy loss. And so whereas in a horizontal branch star, you're actually dominated by the Compton process, by the Compton emission, that process becomes suppressed because of the degeneracy inside a red giant. So that the Bremsstrahlung, which is rather insensitive to the degeneracy, takes over. But overall, you get pretty much the same limit. For the sun, you can also compute the fluxes coming out either from a Primakov-type conversion or from axion-electron couplings, and you get this sort of nice plots. You see all the production processes are essentially in place if you have an axion-electron coupling. Otherwise, for the axion-nucleon coupling, usually you would then go just via the Primakov effect. And this is a sort of fluxes they are looked for with these helioscope-type experiments where you look for the regeneration through the Primakov effect. And so this is how those plots then come together, where you have on top of these stellar constraints, for example, here the CAST experiment, and future experiments which try to utilize this astrophysically generated axion flux here to push the limit even further. But now I would like to switch topic to a different landscape, namely the dark photon landscape. Here again, what is shown is now the kinetic mixing parameter versus dark photon mass. And again, you have a lot of various laboratory constraints and astrophysical constraints. And here I would just like to, so dark photons actually have been mentioned a little bit, but not too much. I mean, you all know it's just a kinetically mixed vector here. You have a new gauge factor, and there are what is important for the astrophysical constraints is how this dark photon actually gets the mass. And so the dark photon can get a mass through what is called a Stackelberg mechanism. So you don't need any other ingredient. You get it for free, essentially. Or you can have the U1 to be Higgs, and then you also have a light Higgs in the game. And that changes the phenomenology.
So wait. So all right. So the only contribution comes then from so that 1, 2, 3, the third term is going to cause interaction with the regular electromagnetic.
Here, yes, yes, right? Yes.
So that's going to add something to the Maxwell equations, right? Or?
Well, yeah. So you can view it in two ways. Actually, you can change pictures. You can rotate this kinetic mixing away, and thereby you get a Miller charge to which the vector is coupling, and this is how you can interact with the vector. Or you can work in this picture of a non-canonical kinetic term where you have sort of a mixing insertion in the phenomenology.
So it will couple to atoms, for example, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Okay. That's the Miller charge. So there will be a coupling kappa times E, where E is just a normal electric charge. It will become clear in a second.
Uh-huh. It's an epsilon photon, or kappa photon.
Right? Yes, with a mass. I actually don't know how much time I have, because we...
You have like maybe a few minutes.
Few minutes, uh-huh. Okay.
Like size three.
Well, this is also Maxime's work, so. Adam's also here, and Haipeng's also here. I don't know if they have some weight.
No. 5 minutes.
Okay, let me cut the story then very short and just explain you how the principal emission mechanism works here and what was the big surprise. The emission process now you can just imagine is coupling your new vector field here to the electromagnetic current essentially, and this can be anything here, and so you write down, you can take your Lagrangian here and use an on-shell condition. You just write in this form and you see that the photon mixes with the new vector, and so the matrix element here will be simply of this form kappa mv squared, then the matrix element of the electromagnetic current, the propagator here of the photon in the medium times a polarization vector. And so if you plug in the longitudinal polarization vector, you see here that 1 power of mv cancels out, so that once you go to the rate, you end up parametrically with a rate which goes like kappa squared mv squared over omega squared, essentially coming from the polarization vector. And this is in contrast to previous claims which said that the longitudinal modes of this massive vector boson goes like kappa squared mv to the fourth over omega to the fourth, omega plasma to the fourth. And so the plasma frequency inside the sun is on the order of kV. And so you can get, for light enough dark photon masses, you can get huge enhancement factors.
Is it more like 100 dB?
300 dB, yes. Order kV is like, can take factor 3. Okay, and so in the end of the day, there is actually, what you find is that there's a resonant way of producing those photons, so you can essentially cut off the matrix element of the electromagnetic part. You can forget about the details of the emission process and really look at this leakage from the photons into the hidden sector. And so the punchline here is that for these longitudinal modes, once they are light enough, you can always hit the resonance, because the resonance condition is just that the energy of the particle equals the plasma frequency, whereas for transverse photons, the mass has to hit the plasma frequency. And for this reason, once you're light enough, you can always resonantly produce them, and that greatly increases the luminosity in this dark photons. And so previous experimental searches here, like the ALPS, the light shining through wall experiments, or the CAST experiments, are now excluded by this astrophysical, by the energy loss from the sun.
It's not like they're excluded, they haven't found anything.
Their experimental efforts are doomed from the outset, because the sun wouldn't be there if a dark photon existed with that coupling. Okay. But in a subsequent work, we showed that you can actually pick up that signal from the sun with dark matter experiments. So though their flux is very low energetic here in the sub few hundred eV range, this is enough energy to ionize, say, outer shell electrons in a xenon atom, and those charges are drifted in liquid xenon experiments, and you can pick up these single or few electron signals. in a dark matter direct detection experiment. And this is what is shown here now. This red line indeed establishes a stronger constraint than the astrophysical one. And it shows a nice interplay between experiment and astrophysics here. And so we are a little bit proud that in the upcoming BDG review, we score the first two places with those two papers. All right. Okay, so I'm out of time. I just wanted to flash that it's also possible using cosmology to push the sensitivity of this mixing parameters to really ridiculous levels, because such a vector, even if it's very weakly coupled, it can be produced in the early universe just through a leakage into the from the Standard Model Sector coalescence into this dark photon. And once you have a certain abundance, and Anthony put a huge effort here in computing very accurately here, what's the dark photon abundance? At a later time, because of their small coupling, they will be just transferred back to the Standard Model. They will inject energy into the plasma, and it can affect various nuclear reaction rates. It's a complicated process taking all this into account, but in the end of the day, you find certain excluded regions in at values of the effective fine structure constant from 10 to the minus 22 to 10 to the minus 36, if you also take the CMB constraints into account. And so putting all together in one plot here, you see now this is the usual plot you see in this dark photon business here for masses above an MeV. I showed you here this landscape plot extended to lower values, but now we can also put here some cosmological constraints in there. Okay, I'll leave it there. Thank you.